Access number 11245, Real One.
Mr. Goldsworthy, Real One. I think that before the war you worked for the Daily Express. How did that come about?
Well, I was a journalist who did the usual 6 years on a local paper, the Northern Echo at Darlington, then joined the Daily Express and was for 6 years their representative in Yorkshire, and then I came to my turn to be called up in 1941.
I think that you served on HMS Prince of Wales.
I was never literally on the crew of HMS Prince of Wales. What happened was that I was in Devonport Barracks as a writer, which is a naval clerk, of course, and I had informed them that I could do shorthand and typing. And then one afternoon I was called over to the drafting office, and the chief petty officer there says, "Can you ride a camel?" So I said, "No, but I can always learn." He said, "Well, you're going off on party zebra." And then I had to go see the drafting commander, who said, "You do shorthand and typing." And I said, "I do." He said, "Well, you get yourself up to Euston Station tomorrow and report to the R2 and say you're for party zebra." It was all very mysterious. And then when we got there, things began to come into place, because the other members of the party, all regular Navy men, were a chief telegraphist, a chief petty officer writer, two petty officer writers, a chief petty officer steward, and I think another three petty officer stewards. So putting all those together, it meant that we were being assembled for the assistance and convenience and the comfort of somebody very important. We were put onto the train and went up to all the way to Thurso at the north of Scotland. Incidentally, I slung my hammock in an empty guard's van on the way, so it was a fairly comfortable journey. And it wasn't until we got onto the quayside up at Thurso that we learned that we were about to board the Prince of Wales.
What kind of impression did the ship make on you?
Oh, well, of course, it was one of our biggest ships at that time. It had already been in battle with the Bismarck. We were given our own mess, and we just waited to see what would happen. And then, very soon after we had joined, the word went round, "Winnie's aboard." And Mr. Winston Churchill, as he then was, had joined the ship, and so had all the chiefs of the various fighting services.
Did you see much of Winston Churchill on board?
Well, in a personal sense, no. But now and again, walking round a darkened corridor, you'd come across this little rather stocky figure, and he'd go past with a sort of grunt. And then the thing that has been a lasting memory for me was that on the following, I'd better give you an idea of what the trip was like, first of all.
Yes.
We went off into the beginning of rough weather, and that night was so rough that the escorting destroyers simply could not keep up with the Prince of Wales, and the choice had to be made between going on and leaving the destroyers behind, or slowing down and being late for arrangements already waiting on the other side of the Atlantic. Because the Captain Leach had been on the ship's loudhailer to tell us that where we were going was Newfoundland, and that Mr. Churchill there was to meet President Roosevelt. Now, my personal experience of that was that night was I came down next morning, there were no destroyers in sight, and I was feeling very, very sick indeed, and I went into the mess and they were ladling out what the Navy calls bacon and red lead, which is strips of greasy bacon floating in the red mush of squashed tomatoes. This I felt was just impossible, but the chief telegraphist, to whom I was already looking on as a sort of father figure, said, "Get that down, you son. Get it down, you." And I did, and within minutes I was up back at the heads getting rid of it. But within 10 minutes after that, I was on the feet and reporting for work. And that's been a lesson to me in a great many shipping occasions since.
You mean it's if you're going to remedy.
If you're going to be sick, have something to be sick with.
What impression did you get of the efficiency of the crew of the Prince of Wales?
Well, I don't think I would pass judgment on that. I was very new. I was very new into the Navy, and it's quite astonishing, in fact, that having been in the Navy barely 6 weeks, I should have been given this assignment. I think it was just fortunate for me and a lucky break.
What happened when you got to Placentia Bay?
When we got to Placentia, we were met by United States destroyers and escorted in. And president, I think, was already there in his cruiser, the Augusta. We didn't see anything of him until the Sunday when he came over to attend a lunch given by Mr. Churchill, which I have the actual seating plan here. I'm sorry, I've rather lost the thread of that.
You were telling me what happened once on arrival at Placentia.
Well, on arrival, they began a lot of boat work between the two ships, and most of the conference was, in fact, I think, taking place in the Augusta, probably for the convenience of President Roosevelt. When he did come over, the main impression he left for me was quite how very crippled he was. When he moved across the deck on the arm of his son, he was only just shuffling his feet like a cripple. But that came to me as very much as a surprise. So I think it was fairly obvious it was more convenient for Mr. Churchill to go to the Augusta than for him to come over. One of the things that I do remember is that president had sent gifts for the whole of the crew of the Prince of Wales, little boxes of cigarettes, orange, apple, all of those sort of things which were pretty scarce back at home. These were being brought onto the ship. And I happened to be walking round when I saw Mr. Churchill leaning over from the rail of a gun turret with shoulder to shoulder with an ordinary seaman, British seaman, and they seemed to be chatting for about 20 minutes. I went down to my cab to the mess and got my camera, and I took a picture there which has had a strange little sequel, actually. Would have been nice to have given it to the paper there and then, but that would have been much too complicated with censorship. And it was something like 20 years after the war I used it in connection with some flashback story which I can't remember, and it did appear in the paper. And then we had a letter from a reader of the Scottish Daily Express saying, could they please have a copy of this picture because they recognised the sailor as this woman recognised the sailor as her brother Jimmy Kelly, she said that when he came back from the Prince of Wales trip, he said he'd been talking to Mr. Churchill, and she said, we just thought he was talking big, and now we know he was telling the truth, which is a rather nice thing. He, by the way, went on with the ship to the Far East and survived the torpedoing, but he died in Sumatra and is buried out there.
Do you have any other memories of the Atlantic Charter meeting?
Well, the thing that was a very lucky break from my point of view was that one day I was alone in the office that we shared between the RAF clerks, the army and the cabinet office attachments, when Sir Alexander Cadogan, permanent head of the Foreign Office, came in, not the Foreign Office, the Cabinet Office, came in and said, do you know where the shorthand writers are? And I said to him, well, I'm afraid I don't know where the Cabinet Office people are, sir, but I'm a shorthand writer if I can be any help. So he said, well, yes, I've got something I want to do before lunch. Will you come down to my cabin? And I went down, and he dictated to me then a signal to the to go to the cabinet in London, reporting the agreement on the terms of what was then called the 8-point plan and is now known as the Atlantic Charter. What was very clear from that incident was that the original draft was by President Roosevelt, and there were a number of amendments by Mr. Churchill, I can remember particularly, he said that before this became official, he would have to consult the premiers of the British Dominions. And that, as I say, was very soon renamed the Atlantic Charter. It was renamed the Atlantic Charter, of course, because the meeting was supposed to have been somewhere at sea, and of course, obviously, in the Atlantic. It was quite a little moment in history. Now, there were on board the Prince of Wales two very well-known journalists, H.V. Morton and Howard Spring, and they had been called at very short notice have an opportunity to see history in the making. But unfortunately, from their point of view, after they had joined the Prince of Wales, it was learned that the President had not brought his usual press group with him. And therefore, to let these two British journalists scoop the American press would have been a recipe for disaster, so they just had to be told, sorry, you can't write anything. But in fact, of course, a couple of years later, H.V. Morton produced a book called Atlantic Meeting, and that sets out the story of it. And one of the things that that mentions is that the charter, as published in London, had four fewer words than as published in Washington. And I've often wondered whether I missed those out in preparing that signal. But I think, in fact, it was probably more a matter of ciphering and deciphering, because it was things like the United States instead of the United States of America and so on. But it was just a little bit of fun, and I wondered whether, having had a chance to see history in the making, I hadn't in a small way meddled with it.
To what extent did you feel that this was a big historic occasion?
Well, it was obviously was a big historic. You don't get the heads of two great nations. And remember, of course, that at this time America was not in the war. They were nominally neutral. And of course, one of the things that was very much concerned with the discussions going on between the heads of the services on both sides was how far they could go as neutrals to assist in our war effort. And one of the things they're doing was a lend-lease arrangement for taking over submarines and so on from the United States to be crewed by some of our European allies.
What about your return from the meeting?
After the after their discussions ready, we sailed to, and I remember that we had, apart from a British escort, we also had two United States destroyers with us. And I said to a yeoman of signals, it's a bit of a much, isn't it? Here's a belligerent battleship and being escorted by neutral destroyers. He said, they're not escorting us. They just happen to be going the same way at the same time. Which was quite amusing in itself. On the way back, we had experience of... incidentally, I may say that Captain Leach came on as soon as we left to say that the world now knew that Churchill was away, and it was a fair guess where he was. And he said, if ever in the history of the Royal Navy there was a need for total vigilance, this is the trip. And he called on everybody to be completely and absolutely on the alert, which of course they were. On the way back, we steamed twice through through a big Atlantic convoy while Churchill stood high up on the bridge giving his famous two-finger V signal, and all the ships were hooting, sirens going. It was a very emotional thing. It was almost, but not as emotional as another experience of mine much later when I was on board the Amethyst going into Hong Kong Harbour at the time when they'd just escaped from 100 days up the River Yangtze.
We'll say more about that later.
Mm. Then we went into a fjord in Iceland, and there were some discussions there. Iceland at that time had American forces there, and part of the operation was just to pay a visit there. And then finally we got back to to Thurso and or to put the great anchorage there, Scapaflow.
If I can jump ahead in your career, I think you spent 2 years, 1942 to 1944, stationed at Gibraltar. What was your job there?
I was, by that time I had become a lieutenant, RMVR, and I was dispatched to Hong Kong as a watchkeeping officer.
Hong Kong?
Sorry, did you say Hong Kong?
Gibraltar.
Can you cut that out?
It's all right, don't worry.
To Gibraltar, as a watchkeeping officer in the Naval Intelligence Center. Purpose of the bread and butter of naval intelligence is to know what ships are doing what and where. And one of our missions was to keep track of all the neutral shipping going from the Iberian Peninsula to South America and so on, so that if a ship sailed from a particular place at a particular time, you could sort of guess roughly where it should be, so that if one of our patrols intercepted a ship and it reported its name to be so-and-so on this voyage and there, they would signal to Gibraltar to say they've encountered this, and get an immediate answer whether that was a possibility or a probability, or maybe we would it might be a contraband runner trying to slip through the contraband control arrangements. But it was a very interesting 2 years, because it was a good billet too, and it was a comfortable sort of place to be. We had a yacht club, and it was, in a way, it was a show place for others, to show that Britain really wasn't in such a terrible state as all that.
What did you get to know about the Germans who were said to be watching the shipping traffic from Algeciras?
Well, I think you're probably a little confused there. It was largely the Italians who were active in that particular part. We didn't find out till too late, but they were mounting attacks on by human torpedoes. But I'd have to start at the beginning to give you that history, if that's what you'd like.
Yes, please.
The Italians had a specialist unit called the 10th Flotilla Mass, the 10th Mass Flotilla, which operated as limpeteers and human torpedo operators to attack shipping in harbours. Their greatest success had been at Alexandria. I'd have to turn up the dates if you want the dates, or
no,
do you want?
That's all right.
Their big success had been at Alexandria, where in one night they knocked out both our Eastern Mediterranean battleships, the Valiant and the Queen Elizabeth, and another ship too, a tanker. In that case, what had happened was they'd been taken by the submarine Shire, S-C-I-R-E, to the vicinity of Alexandria, and then they went on the human torpedoes. Now, a human torpedo looks, in essence, like an ordinary torpedo, but its function is totally different. It provides like a horse for the two riders to ride astride of it, and the forward end is of several hundred pounds of explosive in the torpedo warhead, it's essentially a weapon of stealth. Once detected, they have no defense at all, and the idea is that they creep along unseen into a harbor, reach the target ship. The man on the front is controlling it. The man who is riding behind him then gets off and goes under. They go down underneath the ship, and he puts a clamp onto the port bilge keel, fastens it, and then they pay out a line to the port bilge keel on the starboard side, put another clamp on that, and then they detach their warhead onto, fasten it to the middle of the line, and set the clock and retire. And then in due course, this thing explodes. That is a pretty unhappy thing to happen in the harbour. The remarkable thing about that raid was that the two of them, they had very little hope of getting back to the submarine. They were more or less giving themselves up in one way that they're either going to die or be captured. And a man called Delapen, who was the one who put a bomb onto the Valiant, he didn't follow the intended practice because his number two was in difficulties with his breathing equipment not working properly. So they got near to the ship, and this other chap had to surface. So Delapen then dragged the torpedo a little further on till it was right under the ship, and then they swam alongside. Now, they were spotted from the ship and taken on board as prisoners. And they appeared before Captain Morgan, who demanded to know where they had put their bomb. He guessed what the trick was. But Delapen said, my name is so-and-so, my number is so-and-so, and I'm entitled to refuse any further information. So, you see, the problem was that the ship had already run bottom lines, that's to say, dropped a line over the bows and run it to the back and not encountered an obstruction. They'd also put divers down who couldn't find anything attached to the ship. Now, in fact, it was on the seabed. But if Delapen had told them that that's where it was, then the ship might have been moved to safety. On the other hand, from the captain's point of view, the great danger was if there was an acoustic element to this, the mere starting of the engines in them would in itself set off the. Oh, anyway, Delapen refused to give any information. And Delapen was then told, right, if you're not going to talk, you're going down into the bottom of the ship, and it should be just unfortunate if anything happens. So he and his companion were sent down there and were stayed there for some hours, still refusing to say anything. Finally, he said, I would like to speak to the captain. So he was brought up, and he was asked, what do you want to say? He said, I would advise you to put your crew on the upper deck now, because shortly there will be an explosion. So the captain says, but what we want to know, is the charge attached to the ship or not? And he refused to give any more. He said, well, in that case, you're going down again. And they put him down, and the two of them were down there, locked in a cabin. Meanwhile, they got everybody else up on deck, and before very long there was an explosion. They were not, in fact, hurt by the explosion, because it was at a different part, but it was bad enough to damage the ship and put it out of action for the next 5 months. Then there was a very strange sequel to this. As you know, Italy reached an armistice. Oh, they were sent off to internment in India. And as you know, when the armistice came about, they returned to Italy. And by then, Captain Forza, who was a leading member of this Italian underwater unit, was organizing assistance to the Allies against the Germans, who were still occupying northern Italy. And Delapen